You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
One of the early lessons my children didn't need to learn from me, and somehow discerned and picked up on their own, was that if they kept mom and I separated and asked us the same question, there was a better chance that they'd get the answer they wanted than if they asked us, just one of us, or asked both of us at the same time while we're in the same room. Well, it's a subtle little game that most of your children definitely know how to play. And if you haven't figured that out yet, they're totally pulling a fast one on you daily. And so you need to learn this. So this is a lesson. If nothing else comes to you from the sermon, listen to this. Your children will separate you from your spouse, get you into isolated situations, and come to you and ask, hey, mom, can I watch a movie this afternoon? And they will determine, based on the time of day, based on maybe even the time of the day of the week, that they'll determine ahead of time which parent is more likely to give them the answer that they want. And so they will go to one of the parents, they'll ask the question they want to ask, usually associated with some sort of video game, some sort of movie, or some sort of snack. They'll ask the question, or if you're going to Starbucks, they won't ask in the car. When you're both in the car, when one of you get out, they'll come in with you and ask you inside for the cake ball, poofy lollipop things. Pops. They're cake pops. I like cake ball lollipop. So, and they'll ask this question, and they'll often get different, very different answers from both of you. Maybe you're feeling stricter that day, and so you said no. Maybe that day Jenny is feeling stricter, and so she'll say no. Usually it kind of works that way. But here's the reality is your kids have already learned this. You didn't have to teach them that. There's multiple answers. There's multiple descriptors for what's going to be given to them. If they ask the question of somebody different, they'll hear different voices. John is actually writing into a church in which we know from in the church in Ephesus that false teachers have come and they've begun to declare things that actually aren't true about God and definitely aren't true about what it means to live the Christian life. I mean, John has already been to that church and he's writing back to that church now. And the obvious question that's going to come up from any kind of relatively skeptical person is, who do we listen to and how do we know who we're supposed to listen to? I mean, these guys sound really smart. They sound very spiritual. Most scholars think that these false teachers who are coming into this church are talking in such a way as to make people believe they're teaching from under the inspiration of the Spirit of God directly. God is delivering something to this church to these people, and they're leading that church to believe it. And John is writing back and saying, "No, they're wrong here. They're wrong here. They're wrong here. You need to listen to me. I'm actually declaring to you that what is true, what I've seen, what I've looked at, what I've touched. Listen to me. Don't listen to those guys." And so now we arrive in chapter 3, and John anticipates a question, which is simply this: how do we know who we're supposed to talk to? How do we know who we're supposed to listen to, who we're supposed to obey, what we're supposed to do in the light of this? Like, how do we know that John's not just lying to us? How do we know that John just doesn't have some sort of personal vendetta against these teachers? Or how do we know these teachers aren't lying to us? Who are we supposed to listen to? And that's the issue that John is raising. If I go to mom and I get this answer, if I go to dad and get this answer, who am I supposed to listen to? What am I supposed to do with the two different answers I seem to be getting? And so John is gonna frame this in language that is honestly uncomfortable for us. But we live in a day and age in which we assume what we can see, what we can touch, what we can analyze with our minds is all that's there. But John immediately slips into language about spirits and antichrists. And I think there was like a really scary movie made about Antichrist within the last few years. I don't know if I recommend, I've never seen it. But he starts using this language that sounds very odd to us, sounds very odd, even as we sit in this room and try to understand and discern what it is that John's commanding us. He starts talking, not in terms of just logic and reason, but saying there's actually many spirits at work in the world, many voices at work in the world. And I want to spend just a few minutes before we actually look at John's argument to think about how the world that John describes, so we can step into that and then maybe understand his argument a little bit better. But first, he assumes that we do not live in a materialistic world. In other words, he assumes that what you can see, what you can touch, what you can measure is not how the world actually works. And we assume this every single day. That what matters primarily is logic and reason and thinking and measuring and touching and forming and building and economics and all kinds of different things that make sense to us and are touchable, they're seeable, they're measurable, they're arguable. We assume that this is how the world works, that the world is logical, it makes sense, we can argue for certain things, and we can actually reason together and arrive at the right answer. But John says this is simply not the world we live in. Oh, reason matters, logic matters, thinking matters, measurements matter. For myself, like the narrowness of these chairs matters every single week, and that's a measurable thing. But that's not the only way of understanding and living in the midst of this world. He assumes it's surrounding us. He assumes that I'm at work in this world. In fact, this is assumed on every single page in the New Testament, that this world is shot through with the spiritual. And not shot through with the spiritual, like, hey, every single one of us in this room have kind of a little angel and a little demon speaking to us, but in the sense that the whole world is moved, not primarily by logic, not primarily by things that we can see and measure, but by what Paul would call principalities and powers, by what John calls spirits. Oftentimes, in a materialistic world, like we have movies and we have stories that come out about these kind of personal beings, and they're just kind of one-offs, and they happen to intervene at times. They happen to do sometimes really scary things or really nice things, depending on the movies that you're into, but they just happen to intervene. That's not the world that John's assuming here. He's assuming that literally everything is drenched with motive and will and purpose and power that can't be measured. It can't be tied to one particular government. It can't be tied to one particular news agency. It can't be tied to one particular brand. It is shot through everywhere. Paul will talk about in Ephesians the principalities and powers that this age is ruled over and is ruled by forces and beings and will and volition that's not so measurable as, say, economic pressure or political pressure or social pressure. That there's something else happening in the world beyond what you can measure. Beyond by what you can kind of track back to some hidden office where there's a group of men and women kind of plotting the destruction of us all, or what you should buy next week at the very least. No, running everything, constantly speaking and moving and willing and motivating and lying and telling the truth is something that John describes as the spirits. Something that Paul describes as principalities, as powers, as forces that are hard to name, but are nevertheless at work in the world that we live in. Now, this is so different than the way we assume the world works. But the Bible assumes it everywhere. You do not live in a materialistic age or materialistic world. You do not live in a world that's simply measured by matter and by economic forces. We live in a world motivated by desires and powers and spirits and principalities that are speaking, that are shouting, that are twisting, that are reshaping reality for us in all kinds of ways. And the other thing that John does it's troubling as well, is that he says that in the midst of this world, in a world marked by that, there's really a harsh divide. He does this in his gospel as well, but he does it here. He doesn't leave room for kind of this nice, large, middle gray space in life and in society. He says essentially this, if something is either marked by confessing the reality of who Jesus is, or if they're marked by not confessing that. And notice he doesn't say confessing that thing or denying that thing. He says confessing the person of Jesus or not confessing the person of Jesus. He talks about it in terms of those that are from God or those things that are from the world. And for John, the world is a bad, bad place. It talks about things that are aligned with the person and the work of Jesus, or things that are what he calls antichrist. Again, not some kind of weird personal monster that's going to arise and lead some giant battle somewhere. But the Antichrist means just all the forces that are moving against the purposes of God in the world. That's how John uses that term. In other words, he says that there is no gray area, there is no middle ground. You're either aligned with the person of Jesus, you're either aligned with the confession of who Jesus is, or he calls you Antichrist. Against those purposes, against that good, against the redemption that God has wrought. In other words, John doesn't leave room for middle space. He doesn't leave room for us to say that Jesus was simply a good man. In fact, in John's gospel, one of the key marks of John's gospel is you get to a place in John chapter 6. And these peasants have come to Jesus and they want to eat from Jesus and they want to receive Jesus' teachings and they want Jesus to provide for them, and they're curious about the nature and character of Jesus. And one of the things that's shocking about John chapter 6 is Jesus isn't very Jesus-like in John chapter 6. He keeps raising the bar over and over and over again, never leaving ground for you to kind of come halfway to who Jesus is. I'm never really leaving room for you to negotiate with the kind of God, the kind of Messiah that Jesus is. Jesus just raises the bar, raises the bar, raises the bar, until in the end he stands in front of a group of peasant Jews and says, "If you don't eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can have no part of me." Saying the most offensive and harsh things imaginable and saying, "If you don't come all the way, then you can have nothing to do with me." And John says this is the division that runs all the way through the world. That the spirits either confess, the prophets, the teachers either confess the truth about who Jesus is, that he has come in the flesh, or they actually run counter to everything that God is up to in the world. And they're not from God, they're from the world. If you remember in 1 John chapter 2, John describes for us the nature of the world. It's a society and a life controlled by what he says is the desire of the flesh, the desire of the eyes, and the pride of life. In other words, fed simply by this desire to have every desire met, every desire, everything that you see and desire to go pursue that, everything that your flesh desires, be that pride, be that success, be that wealth, be that the pleasures of this life, whatever it is, pursuing those things and a sense of your identity that is built on your own accomplishments, your own wealth, and what you've done with your life. That's the world. And John says that the whole universe, every thought, every commercial, every sermon, every book that you read, everything is divided between that which is from God and that which is simply derived from this constant desire to be enslaved to what you want, to be enslaved to what you see, to be enslaved to the sense that I can build my own life and make a name for myself. And there is no middle ground. Everything falls on one side or the other for John. In the midst of a world that's organized that way, that's framed like that, we have voices everywhere shouting to us. People are spending millions of dollars to cultivate your desires in a particular way. Music being written, driven by those desires. A whole world that is bombarding us on every possible side with messages that have nothing to do with the coming of Jesus and are trying to do something to us. And so in a world marked like that, how do you walk into a room like this one and discern whether or not God is speaking to you by his Spirit or the world is speaking to you? But what John does is something that is remarkable. He doesn't say that you're going to be able to feel the difference. He doesn't say that, hey, the word that comes from God is going to feel right, whereas the word that comes from the world is going to feel wrong. He doesn't say that that it's going to align with your intrinsic values. He doesn't say that, hey, the word that comes from God, the way you're going to know it's from God and not from other spirits that would lie to you. The way you're going to know it's from God is it aligns with what you already think about the world and the way the world should be. It kind of suits your social agenda or your political agenda or your economic agenda. He doesn't say that that's where the divide is. It's not in your feelings. It's not in the agenda that you think is right already. No, he grounds our understanding of what the voice of God sounds like in doctrine, theology, in a confession about something that is foundationally true about what God has done in history. This is the way that you're going to know that the voice that you're hearing, whether it's a teacher or a commercial or whatever it is, the things that are coming at you, the way that you're going to discern, hey, this is aligned with the way that God is in the world, and this is not aligned with the way that God is in the world. The way that you're going to know it is that it confesses the truth about Jesus. In other words, it may feel weird, it may feel odd, it may call you into places that don't resonate well with your emotions, but does it shout to you over and over and over again, God has come to rescue us in the person of Jesus? Does it affirm you and ground you, not in, hey, your life can be something that you build for your, you can make a name for yourself with your career, you can finally achieve all that you want by gathering stuff. No, does it shout to you? No, your identity and your hope is in something that God has done for you in Jesus. Does it begin to ground your life, not in your achievements, not in your own righteousness, not in your own holiness, not in anything in you at all or anything that you have done at all, but does it pull you back? Does it call you back? Does it ground you in again and again and again the announcement that God has come in Jesus to rescue us, to redeem us, to cleanse us, that he's come in the flesh? This is how the world is divided. It's all about what grounds and defines the world. To announce that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is to announce that in history God has acted to redeem us. It's to announce that in history God has taken on flesh and walked among us and lived the life we couldn't live and died the death that we deserved to die and 3 days later came out of the grave having conquered sin and death and the devil. And everything else in life will be shaped either by the message that that is true. It is life defining. It is history defining. It reorients the whole of your life. Or it will be built on the silence about that. It will be built on a denial of that foundational truth. And John says, this is how you test the spirits. The voices that you hear in your own heads, the voices you will hear as you turn on the TV. Does it make anybody else feel weird? Does anybody know what I'm talking about when I say voice in my own head? Do you guys just think I'm nuts? It's okay. Maybe I am. The stories that you tell yourself about your life and the world, are they grounded in that reality? Are they grounded in that confession, this crazy confession? That God has come in the flesh, that he's come to redeem us and to rescue us. And then John links this for us. Look with me at the back end of that in verse 5. It says, they are from the world, these other prophets, these other spirits, these other voices. Therefore, they speak from the world, and the world listens to them. Verse 6, we, John talking about himself and the other apostles here, we are from God. Whoever knows God listens to us. Whoever is not from God does not listen to us. And by this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. John just kind of lays down an authority card here. He says, if it's from God, you'll listen to us. You'll listen to what we have to say. And one of the most foundational places we call you to go, even as we seek to experience God, to know God by his spirit, is we go back again and again and again to this book. As we begin these groups in this coming week, the first discipline that we're going to talk about is pulling together the practice of daily prayer, of coming into the presence of God and speaking to him by his spirit and meditating on scripture, going back to the words of John and the other apostles again and again and again to meditate, to think, to read, to wrestle, and then to go to God and to experience his presence by the spirit in prayer. That these two things belong together. But one of the things that you'll see, particularly for those of us in this room who haven't grown used to the Bible, is it is so jarring when confronted and placed right in the middle of the world that we live in. Its values, its way of thinking about how life should work, its approach to the way that the world just simply is, its understanding of what good and evil is, its understanding of how we should deal with and live in the midst of this world, the way it talks about the forces around us and the world that we live in. It's just jarring and shaking to the core. It reorients everything. John says, if it's from us, you'll listen to this book. You'll listen to my words, for these are the words that come from God. And so in closing, what does that word sound like? When you go about your day this afternoon and you begin to tell yourself stories again about the world you live in, about the meaning of your life and the meaning of your marriage and the meaning of your kids, what everything's about, how do we discern the voice of God in the midst of all of that? How we determine that it's the Spirit of God coming to speak to us, not just our own stories or stories that are being told to us. It sounds like this. There's a God who created everything and sovereignly rules over everything, such that nothing is an accident. Nothing happens just by happenstance. But this God orders the world in such a way that not one snowflake has fallen today, not even one of them, of the trillions that have fallen in just a scoop of snow through one of those shovels. Not one of them has fallen on accident, but God has ordained all of it to come to pass, and he created the world beautiful and good and flooded with beauty and goodness and truth, and we have twisted it. But this holy God, he hasn't left us to simply twist creation and find ourselves alienated from him, but this God has acted decisively, sending his son in the flesh to live the life we couldn't live, a holy life. A life marked by goodness, a life marked by truth, a life marked by beauty. That he went around declaring everywhere the good news about who God is and God's purpose to redeem all things and make them new. And then he goes, and this holy God who esteems his glory and his name and hates sin, that he, rather than punishing us, rather than causing us and letting us face death forever and ever and ever, he dies on the cross in our place. And this took place in history. It's not a story. It's not a figment of our imagination. It is a confession we have that in history, a man named Jesus was God in the flesh, and he died in our place. And this moment was decisive. It was and is the most important moment in all of history, because in that moment, our sins were dealt with. In that moment, death itself was done away with. And this was proved 3 days later as Jesus came out of the grave. And God's intention to make all things new, to redeem everything in this world, was announced. And this should reorder the whole of your life. It means you don't exist to earn God's love or his favor. It means that your life is not simply the accumulation of wealth or prestige or accomplishment. It means this life is about a life reconciled to this God, knowing this God, and living in the light of who this God is. Loving your neighbor, announcing and enjoying the immense gifts that God has given to us as his people in this world. That's what it sounds like.